People complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. And the people of Israel also wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, and the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance like that of bdellium. The people went about and gathered it and ground it in handmills, or beat it in mortars and boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant, and why have I not found favor in your sight that you laid the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child,' to the land that you swore to give their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me and say, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once if I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." This is the word of the Lord. You may be seated. Well, I want to say a big thanks to Pastor Joshua and our worship team for leading us this morning. It's so good to sing those Christmas songs together. And speaking of Christmas, you might have noticed that the place got a little sprucing up lately, thanks to Tyler and Kara Callahan. And so, Callahans, we really appreciate you guys, decorating wizards that you are, for using your gifts here. I'll just mention that the centerpiece here features a cradle, a cross, and a crown, which is really meaningful symbolism as we think about Christmas. And I'll just dangle this as a little teaser for you. This crown, you may be a little far removed to see it, but you're welcome to see it more closely in the future, is not a crown of thorns, as you might think. It's more like a leafy type of crown. And you might also notice that it has some gold spray painting on it. And there's some particular symbolism to that, and in fact, a particular Bible passage behind that. And so I'll just kind of dangle that out there as a little trivia question. And if you get stumped on it, you're free to ask Tyler and Kara. But you might think about what the significance of that is and why that's especially meaningful for us to have here at Christmas. So, Callahans, thank you so much for your aesthetic and theological vision behind this year's decorations. Sometimes a nation just wants its meat. Such was the case for the United States in the year 1910 when it found itself in the midst of a serious meat shortage. According to researcher and author John Mualim, the causes were multiple: booming city populations, overgrazed rangeland, escalating meat prices. America craved meat, but there wasn't enough of it to go around. Newspapers even began to dub this problem the meat question. And that's when a bizarre coalition of three men proposed an equally bizarre meat answer: hippopotamus ranching. That's right. Hippo ranching. And it almost caught on. The plan was to import hippos from Africa, raise them in the bayous of Louisiana, which aren't good for much else, and serve them up as the new American cuisine. Behind that plan was a clever Louisiana congressman named Robert Broussard, and also two men who had been trying to kill each other for years: Frederick Russell Burnham, the name of the one, and Fritz Duquesne, the name of the other. Now, Burnham is a fascinating enough person to be a sermon illustration all of his own one day. He was the real-life inspiration for the Indiana Jones character and the Boy Scouts were founded in his honor. He was something of a freelance adventurer who, though an American, had served as a spy and fought for the British in Africa during the Boer War. One person described him as, quote, the most complete human being who ever lived, which, as compliments go, is pretty good. Duquesne, on the other hand, was an equally fascinating con man. He navigated life with a series of aliases and had once faked paralysis for 2 whole years while in prison, and on another occasion faked his own death, only to later change his mind and return. I don't know how that conversation starts. I'm back, I guess. Being a descendant of Dutch African settlers, Duquesne had served on the Boer side of the war as a spy and was Burnham's personal sworn enemy. Apparently, the two men had both been assigned to kill each other as their wartime mission. There was certainly no love lost, as Burnham once described Duquesne as, quote, the human epitome of sin and deception, which, as insults go, is a pretty good one. But who would have known that all it took was a little hippo ranching to bring these two together and make them business partners? The men knew from their time in Africa about the potential of hippopotamus as a food source, and together with Louisiana's Congressman Broussard, they formed a group called the New Food Supply Society. Broussard went on to introduce what was dubbed as the Hippo Bill, which sought $250,000 of appropriated funds to transport hippos from Africa to Louisiana. To his thinking, this would simultaneously solve two problems: the nation's meat shortage, and then on the other hand, Louisiana's water hyacinth problem, which hippos love to eat. The water hyacinth, with its beautiful light purple flowers, had come to Louisiana courtesy of a visiting Japanese delegation to New Orleans in 1884. The delegates, no doubt, had meant well, but well-meaning people can cause ecological catastrophes. And so these people had. The water hyacinth, it turns out, is highly invasive, and it was rapidly killing off Louisiana fish and choking off Louisiana waterways. So clearly, the plant had to go, and licking their chops to do it were Broussard and his hippos. Together with Burnham and Duquesne, he set about making the case to the American people. Besides their appetites for hyacinths, hippos are downright huge, the men argued, which can feed lots of people. As one writer put it, a little of him would go a long way gastronomically, which is a really weird sentence. Reportedly, hippos are also tasty. A New York Times editorial called them lake cow bacon, and comparing any food to bacon is just smart PR. Still, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, the bill never passed. Hippo ranching never took off in the U.S. America moved instead in the direction of industrial agriculture with feedlots and confinement operations, which is still the way things happen with cattle today. We got our meat in the end, but we did miss out on a chance for hippo burgers, which is just too bad. The ancient Israelites could also tell you a thing or two about meat shortages. Meat can be hard to come by for nomadic people, and Israel at this time was about as nomadic as it gets. To be clear, they were not drifting aimlessly. God had freed them from their slavery in Egypt. He was heading them toward their home in the land of Canaan, but at this point in time, they were no doubt a people on the move. And they had been this way for about 14 months. Of course, you can imagine the difficulties of trying to feed a nation of more than 2 million people in the wilderness over a period of 14 months. Where in the world do you get food to feed a crowd of this size? Well, if you're Israel during this time, you simply walk outside your tent and pick it up off the ground. Collect it, because God was supernaturally supplying everything they needed. It was this white, flaky substance, sweet to the taste, that God had caused to blanket the ground each morning like dew. The Israelites knew it as manna. And all this while, these 14 months, they had been eating it. And in fact, to all appearances, they had been getting along pretty happily in this way. Content with the Lord's provision, following his commands, meat shortage notwithstanding. It's now been 35 chapters in the Bible without a national rebellion. And not only that, the most recent 10 chapters in the book of Numbers have gone to great lengths to show Israel obeying every single thing the Lord has commanded. which if we've been reading along, has us rolling into chapter 11 with a head steam of optimism, about as much optimism as we can muster. But when we find Israel now, they're a few days removed from the relative fertility of Mount Sinai, and they've entered into a wilderness of inhospitable desert. The sun beats down on them. The miles are long underfoot. The scenery is rough to look at. No Canaan on the horizon day after day as they walk. And suddenly that meatless diet of theirs starts to irk them. Here's where faith will be tested. And for Israel, here's where faith will fail. Here's where a good start goes bad, which is what I'm titling this sermon. A good start gone bad. That change, I think we have to say, literarily speaking, is really jarring for us. Israel has gone from being this obeying people we looked at last week in chapter 10, who are convinced that the Lord will do them good, who are using their own words to evangelize the nations, to now disobedient people in chapter 11, who are convinced the Lord is doing them evil, and who are using their words to complain. Did you get a little whiplash between those two chapters? That's the literary effect. And believe it or not, things even get worse from there. Our text today, I think, divides into two units, the first three verses and then verses 4 through 15. The first section begins a pattern, one that we're going to see some version of over and over throughout this book. And the pattern goes something like this. We see the people's sin, in this case their complaint. Second, we see God's anger. And then third, we see Moses' intercession, which ends the judgment that Israel is receiving. So complaint, anger, intercession. And if we look at the second section, verses 4 through 15, well, sure enough, we see the pattern repeating. The people complain first in verses 4 through 6, just like they did back in verse 1. And then second, God is angry. Look at verse 10. It says, the anger of the Lord blazed hotly. And then we get to our third part of the pattern, where Moses intercedes to stop God's judgment. And we see that in, wait a minute, we don't see it, do we, in the second section? We don't see it. Instead, what we see Moses doing is joining in the complaining, echoing that the Lord is doing evil against him, and telling God that, in fact, he's sick of bearing the burden of carrying this people. It's so bad that he says to God in verse 15 that he would rather die than lead this nation one step farther. Y'all, this is terrible. 15 verses ago, the sun was shining, the birds were chirping, and we couldn't have imagined that things would ever go this badly, this quickly. And yet they have. Not only is Israel rebelling, but Moses is too. The covenant mediator sounds like one of the rebels. Lord, help, we say. And would you believe that that's exactly what the Lord planned to do? To help. He would send another covenant mediator for his people, one who wouldn't lose faith, who wouldn't complain against God's hard providences, and who wouldn't ever stop interceding for his people. One who would never get tired of carrying them. Not ever. That one is the Lord Jesus Christ, the better Moses, and the one who will never get tired of carrying you, fellow Christian. Today, let's look at Israel's good start gone bad, and then let's turn our gaze to Jesus as we prepare to take the Lord's Supper today, the one who loves his people even unto death. All right, let's begin with the first section, the first complaint in verses 1 through 3. I'll read those verses one more time. It says, "And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, and when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them." Now, two things I want you to see, just two things in this section. And first, I just want to cement again in our minds this pattern of complaint, anger, intercession. That's just what we see here. Verse 1, the people complain. Wilderness life isn't what they hoped it would be. Circumstances are hard. They start to grumble. Next, God hears, and his anger is kindled. And in fact, turns out some other things get kindled as well, namely the outlying parts of the camp, which God sends fire to burn. It's not clear whether this was some sort of warning shot across the bow, burning up the area just outside the camp where no one was, or whether what we're being told here is that burned up some of the people in the edges of the camp, some of those tents with occupants in them as well. What is clear is that Israel had better take this seriously. And as it turns out, they do. Which brings us to the final part of the pattern. The people cry out to their mediator, Moses, and Moses intercedes for them in prayer so that God removes the fire. And appropriately, they name the place Taberah, which means burning. So there's the pattern established. Complaint, anger, intercession, and we're going to see some version of this many times to come in the book. Second observation to be made here, and this one I think is significant. In verse 1, we could translate the Hebrew, and it came to be that the people were complaining of evil in the ears of the Lord. I know our translations say something like complaining about their misfortunes or adversity or hardships, and those are fine translations because they do remind us of these difficulties Israel was facing in the wilderness. But the translation evil has at least this going for it. It demonstrates a link that I think the author is trying to make back to chapter 10. Here's Moses in chapter 10, verse 29, when he's trying to join his brother-in-law, convince his brother-in-law to join Israel. "Come with us," he said, "and we will do good to you, for the Lord has promised good to Israel." And then here he is again in chapter 10, verse 32. We translate the Hebrew a little bit more literally. "That good which the Lord will do good with us, we will do good with you." So if you were scoring at home, that's five goods packed there in short order to express unmistakably how Israel believed at that time God would treat them in accordance with his promises and how they plan to treat others. Good, 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 good. And then, in a record scratch moment here, in chapter 11, verse 1, they turn around and accuse God of evil, the very opposite. God is not doing to them the good he'd promised, they insist, but rather mistreating them, rather doing them evil instead. Verse 1 is designed to sound in our ears just as different as it possibly can from chapter 10. God's people are leveling a serious accusation against him. He is up to their harm, not their good, they're claiming. He isn't keeping his promises like he said. The wilderness has swallowed up their faith. They've completely lost the plot. I wonder, have you and I ever done this? Maybe God has taken your life on some twists and turns that you would not have chosen for yourself. Maybe he's made it so that your family moved when you were young. You had to leave all your friends behind. Maybe the man or woman that you hoped to marry dumped you instead, and you were left with a broken heart. Maybe you did marry them, and they turned out not to be Prince or Princess Charming after all. Maybe you lost a job, or lost a friendship, lost a loved one. Maybe the suffering was even longer and deeper than that. Maybe this trek through the wilderness, as it were, bears almost no resemblance to the life you had scripted for yourself. I think it's good for us just to acknowledge that. Acknowledge our hurts and disappointments. And in those moments, I think it's also good for us to follow the pattern that we find in the Psalms, pouring out our lament about these things before the Lord. But to me, what happens in so many of the Psalms, as the psalmists are trying to make sense of their suffering in light of God's character and his promises, is a far cry from what the nation of Israel is doing here, which seems more like accusing God of the evil of breaking his promises. I can't be positive of this, but doesn't it seem like Israel is taking its complaint, like Israel is taking its complaint to the Lord so much as that the Lord, by his omniscience, has overheard what they're saying about him. Right? They're not talking to him, they're talking about him. That seems to be the implication in verse 1 when it says, "The Lord heard it." And that difference between complaining to God and complaining about God also strikes me as a big difference, a significant one. To paraphrase someone, one's a psalm and one's a rebellion. That's how stark the difference is. When we complain to God about what he's doing in our lives, that presumes a position of faith. We haven't turned our back on him. We're still on speaking terms. We even complain because we believe he's able to do something about our circumstances. We are grappling and wrestling and trying to understand his ways and seeking help with that. Lord, you haven't done what I thought you should in this circumstance. I feel completely abandoned by you. I don't like this one bit. That is a biblical prayer. That is a prayer of faith. Just read a lot of the Psalms. God can handle those prayers from his people. You won't scare him off. But that is starkly different than saying, I've considered God's promises, and I've reached the conclusion that God has sinned against me, and that God doesn't keep his word after all. And perhaps even more dangerously, what we hear some say these days, and by the way, you should leave this God as well. That doesn't come from a position of faith. That's actually what rebellion sounds like. That difference, I think, is huge in understanding why Israel is judged in these chapters and why the psalmists are treated gently in their difficulties. I think it's also huge in shaping the way we relate to hurting people, what aspects of God's truth need to come to bear on this person in this situation. I think it's also huge in processing our own hurt. Brothers and sisters, talk to God, not about him. Believe that he still intends good and not evil in your life. And lament your way through the pain until the light breaks in. I've had a few chapters in my life where I have just poured through the Psalms, one after another, day after day, and they've been my only refuge to get me through. And I found myself echoing the kind of stuff the psalmists say. But at least we're still dealing with our God in moments like that. At least we haven't turned our back on him. At least we haven't given up and said he's not worthy of trust. Lament your way through the pain. The Psalms provide the path. That brings us now to the second complaint from Israel in verses 4 through 15. Here's where the meat shortage comes in. And here's how Israel handles or mishandles it. Verse 4 starts out the section somewhat curiously. It says, "Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, 'Oh, that we had meat to eat.'" Now, the rabble, whoever they are, we're told had a strong craving, and then also the people of Israel also wept. Seems to me like it's describing two distinct groups, the rabble and also the people of Israel. And that's led a number of Bible scholars to guess that this rabble here is actually a reference to the Gentile people who joined Israel when it left Egypt, the mixed multitude, as the New King James translates it. So we've got Gentiles craving meat, we've got Hebrews craving meat, and we've got everyone unhappy with this manna diet. Worse yet, they cast a wistful eye back to a certain place where they had more variety. Things like fish, cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, garlic. That place was Egypt. Ah, good old Egypt. Such a culinary hot spot. Had they remembered to give it a 5-star Yelp review on their way out? But what else did Egypt have? Slavery? Cruelty? A homicidal maniac on the throne trying to exterminate their children? But tell me again about how good the watermelons were. These people have forgotten, haven't they? They're romanticizing their past. Forgotten that Egypt was no place to live. And Ian Duguid is right. When we grumble like this, we are adopting simultaneously not only a wrong view of the past, but also of the present and the future as well. We get all of these things wrong. See if I can explain. We get the past wrong because we glamorize it as some sort of golden age without problems, with the help of some selective memory. If Egypt is typological, if it represents life in slavery before knowing Christ, and Canaan is our eternal home, and we're trekking now through the wilderness, do you ever think back to your life before Christ, your life in Egypt, as it were, and say, "Those were the good old days"? Maybe you do. But do you also remember, or can you now, how miserable that life was, not knowing the Lord? The toll that it took on your very soul? The way Satan was slowly destroying you day by day? Not only only that, but when we grumble like Israel, we also get the present wrong because we begin to despise good gifts that God has placed in our hands right now. Israel could have done a lot worse than the manna. You and I could do a lot worse than the lives God has given us at this moment. Saying it was better in Egypt conveniently overlooks how much truly better life is now knowing the Lord, in whose courts are one day better than 1,000 elsewhere. Not to be overlooked in their grumbling, Israel had set themselves against God's plan for their future. He had purposed that he would settle them in Canaan. They wanted to go backward from that goal, back to Egypt. It's as if, to listen to them, Egypt was the land flowing with milk and honey, or at least with fish and vegetables. They couldn't bring themselves to believe that their best still lay ahead. And we can't either. When we look back wistfully on our pre-Christian days and think that those are better than the life with Christ that we will inherit forever on the new earth. As Duguid says, the past is not as rosy, the present not as deprived, the future not as bleak as we might think. And so grumbling is corrosive to faith. May the Lord give us faith not to grumble when life in this wilderness gets hard. Brothers and sisters, it beats Egypt, and we're headed to Canaan. Israel's complaint ends with them running down their present diet of manna in verse 6. They end with, there is nothing at all but this manna to look at. But notice in the next verses, the narrator has a bone to pick with them. Verses 7 through 9. The manna, he's telling us here, is not as bad as these grumblers had made it out to be. First, in verse 7, he says that the manna was not unattractive. It was like a cross between two pleasant things to look at, light in color, like coriander seed, and for its shape, resembling something called bdellium, which was this fragrant gum rosin prized for its use by perfumers. So positive associations, right, in the way this manna looked. Second, in verse 8, he makes the point that it wasn't incapable of variety. You could prepare it in a lot of different ways. Third, the end of verse 8 says that it wasn't bad tasting. It was like a pastry prepared with oil, some of our translations say. Apparently it was sweet. In Exodus 16:31, it says it tasted like wafers made with honey. It's pretty good, right? And it wasn't like Israel had been consigned here to eat Brussels sprouts for the year. The manna was good. Apologies if you really like Brussels sprouts. Not my favorite. Fourth, verse 9 adds that not only was it not attractive, not only was it not incapable of variety, not only wasn't it bad tasting, verse 9 adds, it wasn't hard to come by. Came every night with the dew, waited for them right outside their tents, easy to pick up. So manna, to say this in positive, was an attractive, good tasting, readily available food that lent itself to variety in preparation. Checks a lot of boxes. You could do a lot worse than manna on a trip through the wilderness. And in verse 10, the camera, as it were, cuts away to the people of Israel who are celebrating this wonderful gift of manna by weeping at the doorways of their tents. What? The narrator wants us to see how deeply out of place this is. Israel responds to God's good gifts by throwing this full-scale, nationwide pity party and pining for Egypt. And in keeping with the earlier pattern, in verse 10, we see God's anger burn. It's just what happened the last time the people complained, and it signaled judgment coming, which it certainly does here again. We'll just read on in chapter 11. But we say, never fear, I memorized the pattern in the first three verses. I know what's coming next. Moses, gallant hero that he is, will intercede. The judgment will be checked. Israel will be saved. Except when we get to the end of verse 10, that's not what we see. Our translations say that Moses was displeased or troubled. We could also translate the Hebrew here. And in the eyes of Moses, it was evil. There's that word again. We saw it in verse 1. And to confirm what sense it's being used here, look at verse 11. Here's my translation of the Hebrew. And Moses said to the Lord, why have you done evil to your servant? I think the narrator is deliberately comparing Moses here to the rest of Israel in verse 1 and showing how, even though they're complaining about food and he's complaining about them, he has now, in effect, sided with them in the practice of complaining against the Lord. What Moses and Israel share in common right now is that they are both convinced deeply that God has done them wrong. Moses is even going to use the word evil again at the end of verse 15 to describe what's become of his life. Gone are the five goods from chapter 10 to describe life with God, and in their place are the four evils, accusing God of doing that here in chapter 11. And I'll just let the record show, 75% of those come from Moses, the nation's leader, the one who is supposed to walk the most closely with God and trust him the most fully. In chapter 10, Moses had assured Hobab, his brother-in-law, that, quote, the Lord has promised good to Israel, but somebody keep Hobab out of earshot now, because Moses is sure that God has dealt ill or done evil to your servant. The wheels have come off. Faith has just fallen flat on its face. 10 glowing chapters in this book have just given way to spiritual catastrophe. Turns out you can crater a nation in just 15 verses. And I wish I could tell you that this was the end of this unpleasant incident, but unfortunately, Moses is just getting warmed up. Verses 11 through 15 are one big, long prayer of complaint. In verse 11, we saw Moses blame God. In verses 12 through 14, it's an even more disheartening turn. Moses doesn't want to lead the people anymore. He says he's tired of carrying them. He's not their mom. Somebody else can lug these big babies around. They have become an unbearable weight to him. The covenant mediator is searching for an eject button. He wants out. And in verse 15, he thinks he's found the exit strategy. He begs for death. If this is how you're going to treat me, God, he says in effect, do me the favor of ending my life right here, right now. Man, not only keep Hobab out of earshot, keep all the Israelites out of earshot of this prayer. How discouraging for anyone to hear. Someone has even noted that it's instructive to count the number of times Moses refers to himself in the prayer. But by my count, I've got 14 in the original Hebrew, several of them these emphatic first-person pronouns. I think it'd be fair to say that Moses is chiefly thinking of himself here. This arrangement isn't working for me, he says. Not exactly a portrait of selflessness, is he? And that's where today's text ends, verse 15. You're saying, I was expecting a happy note. Well, you don't find it in Numbers 11. You don't find the happy note in Numbers 11, but perhaps all of that dissatisfaction that we're feeling right now toward Moses is designed to serve us in a counterintuitive way. Rather than centering our hopes on him, or even on this arrangement where Moses is the leader of God's people, I think this chapter leaves us longing for a better arrangement, one in which the covenant mediator doesn't get tired of carrying his people, one in which he doesn't lose his temper and get frustrated with them, one in which he doesn't accuse God of doing him evil when he sends him to serve them, one in which he doesn't think only of himself, one in which he stays on mission to lead them into rest, even when it cost him his life. That new and better mediator that the Bible presents to us, brothers and sisters, is Jesus. And Jesus will never get tired of carrying you. Has your faith fallen on its face in the wilderness? Doesn't it for all of us? Have you, like Israel, grumbled about God's provision in your life? Have you found yourself wistfully looking at Egypt and longing for your pre-Christian life? Maybe that fills you with shame this morning. Maybe you wonder if Jesus is about ready to put you down. Jesus isn't tired of you. Jesus isn't tired of you. Jesus isn't standing in heaven now asking for someone else to do the job. Jesus isn't saying, I'm not his mother. Let somebody else put up with this. Now, Jesus, the author of Hebrews, says, always lives to make intercession for his people. Always lives. You never get too heavy for him to carry with all the mess that you bring.
He never wants to wash his hands of you. In fact, when you sin, his compassions are aroused for you all the more. He moves towards you in grace, not away from you in repulsion. Isn't that amazing gospel news? To let it seep down into your soul. Jesus isn't sick of you. He isn't today. Sometimes we may feel like we've become an insufferable burden to him with all of our grumbling, all of our faith failures. But Jesus doesn't see you that way. Listen to what the Gospel of John says about Jesus' love for his disciples, who, let the record show, performed less than admirably. They questioned. They grumbled. They were slow to believe. When Jesus needed them to pray with him in the garden, they fell asleep on him. When he was arrested, they all ran off and deserted him. And yet John writes about Jesus in chapter 13, verse 1 of his Gospel. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. That's how Jesus loves you. That's how he loves you, Christian, to the end.